The time being 8:16, the House Health and Human Service Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum, and since he was the first one here, Representative Gander gets the honor of moving the minutes from April 10th, 2025. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes from April 10th, 2025? Seeing none, Representative Gander renews his motion that the minutes be approved from April 10th, 2025. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. There. A few housekeeping things as we get settled into this next round. Welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives. We appreciate your interest and participation in the legislative process. To ensure everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all of our attendees, please note the following guidelines. I, the committee co-chair, maintain control of the proceedings and establish the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause and other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways and aisles, or standing or obstructing the view of the chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak with our sergeant staff, identified by gold ties. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony may be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it, as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. Does anyone need help with the life jackets, or are we good? Very good, then.
Mr. Chair, is it possible just to post the statement outside so people can understand the decorum and everything else rather than reading every hearing? Otherwise, it's going to take us almost 5 minutes of that reading.
Chair Knorr, I believe that that will be also posted elsewhere, and I'm sure people will go back and watch that recording again and again if they can't sleep at night. So we've got that. First on the agenda today is House File 3379, and I will make my way to the table, and Representative Gilman will take the gavel.
All righty. All right, so the first bill on today's agenda is House File 3379. Chair Schumacher, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 3379 be re-referred to the General Register.
Awesome. We have three amendments. We will start with the A3.
Madam Chair, if I could just introduce the bill.
Sorry, introduce
first,
the
please.
Bill. I want to speed along here. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3379 is intended to be a technical bill. Because of the things that we had seen over the summer for one of the programs in the human service area, the Housing Stabilization Supports area, because the state had requested that the program be terminated and CMS had approved that, the intent with the bill today is to remove that from statutes so that when we're ready to bring that program back to the Department of Human Services, that the legislature has a check on that again. And I think we've learned with the way that the program was structured in its current form, and it was noted to me over the summer that there was a very bright, young, but foolish chair of the Reform Committee at the time when this was approved. We're just going to make a few changes to that. But really the idea is to have it out of statute so that we're in compliance with what the department had requested for the program to be terminated, that CMS approved for the program to be terminated. And so when it is ready to be brought back, the legislature is a part of that process to bring it back. And so with that, I will turn it over for amendments.
All right, so we'll start with the A3 amendment. No?
Mr. Chair, A3 is an amendment to A1 amendment.
There we go. Yes. Okay, wonderful. All right, we're going to switch it up. We're going to go to the A1 amendment.
Good choice, Madam Chair.
And I, all right, so Chair Noor, please, would you like to move your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, I think that chair that you were explaining, I hope it wasn't you at that moment. So hopefully we can put the record straight. So I think also last year we put some safeguards to the program because we meant to make sure that the program was more functional. We put all those safeguards at that point. Regardless of that, I think the A1 amendment is more of a clarity of what is legislative intent, what is the role of legislature compared to what is the role of the executive branch. So this amendment has got two sections. One is whenever we have Medicaid waiver request or Medicaid state plan amendments as required, there's a requirement for public comment for 30 days, making sure that the text for those public comments are published on the website so that the public has got access to that information. On the second section of that amendment, it states that the commissioner shall not do the following. Number one, terminate any Medicaid program, waiver, or benefit that is enacted legislatively, and also request that the agency not request assistance from the federal government to terminate any Medicaid or waiver or benefit that has been legislatively enacted. Likewise, we're stating that any time that there's substantial redesign in a Medicaid program or benefit, that it has to come through legislative process. So this is just more clarity of what is the role of the executive branch and what is the role of legislature. So that is just making sure that it's plain clear.
All right. I'd like to roll call this, and is there any further discussion?
Well, Madam Chair, I have an amendment to the amendment
on
that one.
Thank you.
So I will move the A3 amendment to the amendment for the A1 amendment there. And really, I appreciate Chair Noor's work on this piece. I know we talked several times over the summer about what role the legislature has in this process, or what role the legislature is supposed to have in this process. And so we have that. There was some concern as we were reading through the amendment overall, and Chair Noor and I have talked about this a little bit, that there was some concern that the legislature would have to be called back in for, if there were changes made during the interim, that the legislature would have to be called back in to have those changes. And we didn't want to have to keep a program going that the department was ready to terminate just because the legislature wasn't in session at the time. And so offering the A3 amendment to the A1 amendment to feel more comfortable with the efforts of the A1 amendment for that, and give that to the group for consideration.
All right, discussion to the amendment.
Madam Chair and members, Mr. Chair, I think your intent is in good faith. But then the question that I have right here is, we have extended the authority given to the commissioner by allowing a commissioner to terminate any program based on credible allegations. Nothing substantiated. So if the commissioner today decides that they're going to terminate assisted living program, does this section allow the commissioner to terminate without any authorization from legislative body?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. from my reading of it, it would for that.
Chair Noor.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, The question is, we haven't centered in this amendment. What happens to the participants who will be in that setting, in an assisted living, because it's a residential setting, that is meant to provide services to seniors and people with disabilities who are in that setting? What will happen to those individuals when the program is terminated through executive branch legislation that we already have in front of us here?
Chair Schumacher.
Madam Chair and Chair Knorr, that process for what's laid out in statute already, I think it's a little light in that, and I think we'll be having further discussions in other bills this year on what the process is when that happens. But it's silent in this bill for that.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, as we deliberate on budget issues, what happens to that fiscal note that was associated with that budget in that specific program? Where does it go?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Knorr. It's my understanding that that rolls back in, because these are forecasted programs, back to the general fund.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, don't you see the problem now? We're now dealing with the executive branch legislating, taking away codified legislation that says, we care about the people that we're providing services. We will prosecute and go after anybody who's committing fraud. But at the same time, we're looking into credible allegation. Is this not a tool that is already existing in the system, using that section that is included in there, 256B.064? Is that not a process whereby we look at case by case? If I may ask can I ask the nonpartisan staff just to describe that whole section so that we can get a clear picture? Is this something that is already authorized under the law so that the commissioner can use when instances of program issues happen?
Mr. Chair and members, 256B.064 is the section of statute that governs MA sanctions and monetary recoveries, and the specific citation in the A3 amendment describes what a credible allegation of fraud is under that section, and it includes fraud hotline complaints, claims data mining, and patterns identified through provider audits, civil false claims cases, and law enforcement investigations.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, you can see that it's a sanction that is already authorized for doing payment withhold based on credible allegation. So if we are giving the commissioner the authority to terminate any program or waiver or benefit based on that, technically we should just give our certificates to the other side and just walk away. And to me, this is a crisis that we cannot let happen. And so this amendment is not solving the problem of what we're trying to solve.
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Knorr. I appreciate the perspective on that. I see it just a little bit differently, and just how it was presented here. If they've already have the exercises with that, this is more comfort language to go with the A1 amendment for that, and would ask for your support.
All right, so we have, Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, everybody. It's good to be back. So similar concerns to Chair Knorr, but I'm just gonna put it in terms that someone who's not a chair can say. And this amendment, Chair Schumacher, is effectively what the current administration and DHS have already done to human services. Your amendment would codify what they have already done and the measures they took, discounting several conversations and advice from community members, from legislators ourselves, that were explicitly meant to remove any sort of conversation and power from the people. Your amendment codifies that process in what we saw happen over the last several months. I really caution this committee to give that kind of power to an agency when the legislators are the people meant to be serving our community. And I just, frankly, the administration and DHS royally screwed this process up by just deciding to terminate programs, by saying, we're not sure if we have authority to do this, so federal government, why don't you just, can you help us close this? Because, you know, like a seven-year-old, you didn't say we can't, but does that mean we can't, right? That's what this codifies, and what the A1 does is says, no, you can't just do that. You have to give the option for the public to weigh in. You have to give the option for legislators who represent the public to weigh in. Throughout the interim, we had several meetings where the words of our constituents were not only discounted, but were laughed off, were shrugged off, or were left on the table while folks stormed out of the room, mm-hmm. including our administrative staff and our governor. This is the kind of growing government through power and policy that I think none of us want to see. The A1 is the amendment that everyone wants to see, that if you want to make changes that affect people, people get to make that choice. And if that means that we have to come back to work for a few more days than 3 to 4 months out of the year, I think we're obligated to do that. I think we're obligated to meet that crisis and come in and do our jobs rather than try to savor 7 to 8 months off throughout the year where we can't do anything. We tried to come back. We tried to have a hearing. And because the administration and DHS wanted what's in your amendment to happen, they pulled the levers to make sure that we never got that hearing. So I just caution members again that if this is the direction that the committee wants to go, we might as well not have a Human Services Committee to make decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Is there any further discussion? Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I may not have gone to the Learning Center. I went to a learning center. But what I do know about this bill is that if this amendment isn't passed, it basically says that we want fraud to happen unless the legislature steps in. And the legislators themselves do not call a special session, so we can't really come in and do a couple extra days of work unless it's agreed to by the governor to do so. And with all the fraud that has taken place in this state, billions and billions and billions of dollars, the legislature has not once been called in for a special session to deal with it.
Any further discussion? Yes, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No one here accepts fraud at all. We are all against fraud. What we are concerned about is making sure our most vulnerable people, our people that we're supposed to serve in the state, continues to receive the services that they deserve. And what happens here is that when you have this kind of provision in there, people who are entitled and need the services are going to lose those services and be left, as we've seen in the past, been left on the side, not taken care of. In some instances, we've heard of reports that they've died. So as a result, we need to have our oversight in there so that the administration just can't turn around willy-nilly and terminate programs without decent programs to take care of our most vulnerable.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. You know, why this is a good amendment is exactly what you said, Representative Fisher, is because we want to make sure the dollars are being used for the people who need it. When dollars are being used for non or fraud actions or something else, that means we're taking services away. You and I are on the same page. We want to get the dollars to the right people. But it didn't work this time. If we keep doing what we're doing, then we're going to continue to not provide the services to the folks who need it. And that's one of the things I kept hearing over the last couple of months. So this is a good common sense amendment. Thank you.
Representative Franzen.
I would say that we have had years and years and years to address fraud. And every time amendments were brought up when we were in the minority, they were either ruled out of order or they were voted down. And we are at this crisis now where we are the laughingstock of the nation. all the news stories about all the fraud that has taken place in Minnesota. And quite frankly, it's embarrassing. It's still embarrassing that nobody is ever held accountable. We got to this spot because it was allowed to get to this spot. And now there are some consequences that are going to be paid. Do I like it? Absolutely not. But we have to end the fraud and make sure that it's going to the money, the tax dollars are going to the people that actually deserve it and not people that are sending their money overseas, buying fancy cars and new homes, and just ripping off the Minnesota taxpayer.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know, Mr. Chair, some people will get confused with this whole process, but let's call it a spade. This is not the legislation that is going to stop fraud. It's not. It does not. Because we have to be able to first stop fraud before it happens. It's our responsibility to put those safeguards. And if we fail and start finger pointing at each other, we have failed the state of Minnesota. We're here to get to work to solve the problem. And whereby before it happens, before anything is created, we have to be able to hold ourselves accountable. Are we putting the safeguards necessary? Are we making sure that we are holding agency accountable? Are we holding ourselves accountable? Because we can't blame somebody else when we're sitting here deliberating in how we fix problems. And if there's a problem, it's our problem. And if we don't fix it, nobody else is going to fix it. So let's get to work and solve the problems that are before us. And I think there's a necessary tools that we can put in the system that will help deter the process of those who are committing fraud, stop it before it happens, because if we're going to chase up after things have happened, we have failed. Those are things that we have to discuss this session and to be able to give the confidence, the trust. Remember, there are people who are elderly, disabled, individuals who are depending on us to make sure that we protect them and we protect the services that they're getting. And that is our role. And I know I had conversations with the chair. We're going to have continued conversation in how we protect the system so that nobody commits fraud. At the same time, the individuals who are now thrown to the streets, who are struggling, they matter the most. They're the victims of this whole process. And we don't need to victimize more without having those guardrails. So, Mr. Chair, I think we've had some conversation that we're going to be having more deep dive into this, and I think we will continue to have. So I'll withdraw the amendment so that we can continue to have that conversation based on our conversation that we had last night. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Noor. All right. Okay. All right. So we will. Do you have any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I think you'll want to announce for the record that the A1 amendment was withdrawn.
So the A1 amendment has been withdrawn, and we are back to the A3 amendment.
Well, the A3 amendment doesn't have
then that's gone too.
Ship to sail on with that one. So, Madam Chair, if I could please move the A2 amendment. This is a technical amendment from the nonpartisan team to clean this up a bit more.
All right. So would you like to move your A2 amendment?
I move the A2 amendment.
All right. All those in favor, say aye. All those opposed, nay. All right, the A2 amendment is adopted. Oh, further discussion to the bill. Thank you so much. Okay, I see no further discussion to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will renew my motion that House File 3379 be re-referred to the General Register and thank the members for the discussion today. Obviously, this is just one step in the process. We just wanted to try to get the ball rolling a little bit. We could have maybe, and I'll just make this one little editorial note, and to thank Chair Noor because our day was supposed to be tomorrow and this bill was supposed to come up, but I have some things that are going to pull me out of town tomorrow, and so he was gracious enough to switch up the days for us, and that's why some of this got to be a little bit more or a little bit faster paced than what it needed to be with that, and I apologize for that. Part of it. And so as we move forward with this, there's going to be further communication and further discussion on not only this issue, but some larger issues. And I'm looking forward to the work that we're going to be able to get done this session to help the people that were actually out here to try and help. And so thank you for that and ask for your support.
Wonderful. So Chair Schumacher renews that House File 3379 as amended. Yes, thank you. Be placed on the general register. All those in favor, aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The motion passes. House File 3379 is recommended to be placed on the general register.
Thank you, members.
There we go.
That was a close one. And I needed to make that last comment just in case you didn't see me tomorrow and thought that I was pouting or something. I stopped pouting like 2 years ago, so this is much better. Next on the agenda for today is a presentation by the Department of Human Services with implementation updates from what we were able to accomplish during the 2025 session. And with us is Director Grom and Director Bailey. Directors, welcome to the committee. Whenever you're ready, please state your name for the record and present your testimony. Or whenever the screens are ready. Yeah,
thank you, Chair Schumacher. We are trying to get the screens up. We need assistance.
Does anyone want me to read that document again while we're waiting?
No.
Oh.
There we go.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elise Bailey. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services. I'm here with, you want to introduce yourself?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services, Director of State Government Relations. Thanks for having us.
And today we're going to go over, as the chair said, implementation updates and just kind of go over what the department has been working on since we last met last session. So DHS, as you can imagine, has been really busy over the interim. Some highlights of what has taken place over the interim are we did the final splitting of DHS into three separate agencies. That has been a few years in progress, and as of this fiscal year, DCYF in full and DCT has split. Prior to this year, we had some bits of DCYF within our agency still, and DCT was still within DHS last year. So this is the first year where we are completely split into our own agency. We've also spent most of the interim responding to lots of federal changes and risks, and I will go over that in our presentation today, just so that it really grounds our conversations in terms of timeline of when the changes you passed last session are looking to get implemented. Third, we are busy implementing all of the 2025 session changes, whether that be working with CMS for federal approval or hiring and changing our systems to be able to implement those. And I'll go over some key highlights there. And then we have been busy doing program integrity actions. And I think with this presentation, we'll go over one topic, but tomorrow we're coming back with a more robust discussion on that. So diving into the federal pressures, just to kind of lay the groundwork of what we've been working on over the interim. First that happened over the interim was, of course, H.R. 1 passed on July 4th, 2025. This is the biggest change to the Medicaid program since its, I think, since the ACA. And a lot of changes will impact the people that we serve on the Medicaid program, as well as the counties and tribes who administer the program and DHS in terms of timeline and being able to roll out large changes. So these changes, I have them on the slide here. I'm not going to go over them in a lot of detail, but I wanted to lay the groundwork of this has been a lot of work with a lot of parties that we will have to grapple with in the coming months in implementing. Some key highlights are some populations will have to do work requirements. We'll have to move to 6-month renewals rather than 1-year renewals for some populations. Some people will have cost sharing requirements, whereas under current law, they do not. There's changes to retroactive coverage periods, and those vary by population. There's changes to criteria in terms of who is eligible for the Medicaid program. And there's changes to the federal funding that the state receives for some services and some people related to Minnesota Care and MA. And then there's pretty big changes to how the state can set up our health care taxes. I wanted to highlight this just because it increases the complexity of the Medicaid program and both people accessing the program as well as administering MA. And there are large financial impacts both to providers, hospitals in terms of uncompensated care, as well as the state and counties. So kind of a big deal in our world in implementing all of the changes. So the next piece of the federal pressures we've been grappling with at the department are just the funding and volatility in terms of how much funding the state gets from the federal government and how certain we are we'll continue to receive them. So, of course, we had the largest government shutdown in the nation's history this fall. And at the state, we have to monitor the impacts to our programs. Given the large amount of federal funding that make the wheels turn here. There have also been interruptions in grants, modified terms of how we can spend the grants, and changes in federal guidance depending on what grant the state is receiving. We have seen changes in how our state plan and waiver amendment requests are scrutinized by the federal government. In terms of timing, in previous years, you know, the amount of days for a state plan amendment may be around 60 days. In 2025, it's over 90 days. We're seeing more questions and more instances where the federal government, quote unquote, stops the clock, and I'll go over that later in terms of the process. But that means that our timelines that we anticipate in the bills that you pass may not come to fruition, that they will be delayed. We also have risks of withholding of federal payments. So on January 6th, CMS sent DHS a letter and the governor a letter that they intend to withhold about $550 million per quarter of federal funding. With that letter, we had the opportunity to submit an appeal. And that is pending right now. $515 million per quarter is over $2 billion a year. And just to kind of articulate what that really means, last session, we had a savings target of about $1.09 billion over 4 years. So cutting $2 billion in 1 year is a big deal. We've also been told that there are risks of a deferral. So deferrals are a different process from the federal government where they're looking at claims that they already paid us versus a withhold is withholding future money from the state. CMS has indicated that they may undertake the separate process where they're looking into claims they've already paid, and they may defer or take back funding. That is unknown, the amount, the scope, and the timing of that. So DHS, more than half of our budget comes from the federal government. We, in 2026, based on the most recent forecast, we're anticipating about $14 billion from the feds and about $10.8 billion from the general fund. So just to paint the picture of how important our federal funding partners are in running the human services system. So as you can imagine at DHS, we are really focused on preserving Medicaid, making sure that people across the state have access to the critical supports that Medicaid provides. We serve over 1 million people across the state. It's the biggest single insurer of our population. And so these risks to our federal funding are critical in making sure that we ensure the infrastructure and the healthcare infrastructure in the state. You can slide. Yep. Okay, so moving into the what was passed in 2025, just a reminder on this slide, where we landed last session. So the net general fund impact in the Chapter 9, which was the Human Services Budget Bill, was about $270 million in 26-27 and $820 million in savings in 28-29. DHS had a larger share of that because, of course, that bill impacts multiple agencies. We had a lot of items in that bill. On the spreadsheet, we had over 57 budget items in the DHS spreadsheet. Many of them had multiple components that have to be seek federal approval separately. And looking at that HHS bill, the Chapter 3, some of the items that you passed in this committee also landed there, given the different jurisdictions. And we also had a savings target in that bill, about $98 million in 26-27 and $298 million in the tails. In that bill, we had over 47 budget items. Of course, we also had policy items scattered throughout those bills that sometimes require federal approval as well. Okay, so just to briefly go over what our federal approval process is at the state and our partnership with CMS. So legislation, of course, passes around May or June, depending on the year. And when that passes, we then get busy in terms of drafting and preparing our state plan or waiver amendments. The process varies depending on whether the change needs to be put in a state plan amendment, what is also called a SPA, or a waiver amendment, which is our waivers such as the DD waiver or the CADI waiver. There are different processes for those. Some changes need to go in multiple waivers. For example, we have multiple disability waivers, and many times those changes span all of those waivers. So a lot of the work at the department are looking at, of all the things that passed, where do they need to land in the state plan, where do they need to land in the waiver amendment, and packaging those items appropriately. That takes a lot of planning and work, so there's a lot of time that is involved in that. Also, drafting the specific changes in the waiver plan. A lot of times the language isn't necessarily copying and pasting from the state law, but rather making it fit within the waiver and state plan language. We're also, in this time period, planning our implementation. So what kinds of systems changes do we need to do? Again, because we have so many items that passed, and say we fiscal note each individual item, we're mapping out how do you do all these changes by the timelines that the legislature is requesting us to do it. And so it's a huge project plan, both on the federal approval side and on the implementation side. Once we put all that together, then we have a public notice and public comment period. We're required to post most changes for at least 30 days for the public to have the opportunity to comment on the changes in those amendments. Around this time, say this is maybe the fall, we're also finally getting the funding that was appropriated. So it takes some time for the agency to actually receive the funding in hand to, say, start hiring. This means that all this work prior to that is done with current staffing levels. So it is many times a challenge to fit all the work in after legislative session, especially when we have many items that passed into law. And then our hiring process begins when we have FTEs appropriated to the agency. Then we submit those items to CMS, and that begins a 90-day clock. So CMS has 90 days to approve the changes in our amendment. Within that time period, a lot of times we're working with CMS on what we typically call informal questions. So they're asking us specific questions around all of the changes we are requesting, and this doesn't stop that 90-day clock for these informal questions. DHS tries to answer those pretty quickly, because if they remain unanswered, CMS has the option of doing what's called an RAI, a request for additional information. It is a formal notice that they need these questions answered, and the clock stops. That means that the timeline that we will likely get approval for that amendment will likely shift out. So once we receive an RAI, of course, the department's attempting to answer those questions as quickly as possible. When we answer them and submit our response to CMS, the clock starts again, but it's a new 90-day clock. And so, as you can imagine, that delays potential implementation timelines, depending on how long CMS then takes to approve the amendment. During this time period, as well as sometimes after we get, we're getting approval, we are doing the final systems work. So a lot of times we may get approval, but the systems work isn't done to actually implement the change. So that's another variable in terms of when we can roll out a change that you passed into law. And then, of course, we implement the change once we have all of these items done. Okay, I'm going to dig into the specific changes. I'm curious, Chair, do you want me to stop for questions or wait till the end?
Are there any questions currently for Director Bailey? Director Bailey, please proceed.
Okay, so digging into the specific changes that you all passed into law last year, the first round of changes on this slide are the changes to nursing facility payments. As you can see, we had several changes in this category. The first change we have implemented on October 1st is the patient-driven payment model, or PDPM. This changed how rates were determined based on the person's level of acuity or level of need. This was a change that was essentially required by the federal government because the previous way that we index rates to need was sunsetting. And so this needed to be implemented by October 1st. We have implemented this. This one is also awaiting federal approval, though, at the moment. So we have implemented it, but we are awaiting federal approval. The next several items are items that reduced some portions of the nursing facility payment rates. So one part of the rate is the alternative payment system, or APS, property rate that repealed the automatic inflationary adjustment. The second one indexed the operating part of the rate going up over time to CPU or 4%, whichever is lower. The third one applied an increase to the surcharge that nursing facilities pay, and then applied a add-on to the rate. All of these are pending CMS approval at this moment. And I would note that the surcharge and add-on changes will have an end date. Because HR1 passed into law, and because there's changes to what states can do related to healthcare taxes, this part of the changes last session can only be implemented through October 1st.
Thank you, Director Bailey. Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question on the effective dates. If we don't meet those effective dates, what happens to the savings that we banked on the budget?
Director Bailey.
Chair Knorr, great question. Those savings would be adjusted in the forecast.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if that means it's adjusted, does it show in the February forecast that we're not getting the savings? So does it increase the fiscal imbalance that we will be seeing at the state level.
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, yes. With this particular item, we had two changes, right? We had increased a surcharge, which was revenue that was coming into the state. We have a revenue forecast. And then we had rates that were added to the nursing facility rates, and there was a savings between the two. So yes, to answer your question, both items will be adjusted in the forecast, and the net impact will be a cost to the state compared to what we previously projected.
Any other questions on this? Director Bailey.
Okay. The next one is the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. This item increased rates to the nursing homes, and it is currently pending CMS review and approval. The next one phases out single bed incentives, and this one, the next two are not effective until January 1st, 2027, and so they are not currently in a state plan amendment. They will be in future state plan amendments. One thing I forgot to mention in the previous slide on the actual process, in terms of effective dates when we have delays, it really varies in terms of whether we can go back to a previous date before CMS approved it, or whether we need to only move forward. With these items, because they're in a state plan versus a waiver amendment, we can go back to the effective date of as long as when we submitted the SSPA, the state plan amendment, as long as we submitted it within the quarter that we want to make it effective for. So with all of these, we are assuming we would still be able to have an effective date of January 1st. But you'll see in future slides in terms of waiver amendments, that rule is different. We can only move forward. And so there are larger effective date delays. Okay, the next slide goes over some changes that we had to the Min Choices assessment. The first one was a change to have the ability to have an attestation from the person that is being served that they had no changes in needs or services. This is for ages 21 through 64. This one was, the target effective date was January 1st, 2026. This one is pending CMS review and approval. And as I mentioned, because this would be in a waiver plan, it would, you know, if it did get approved, it would be delayed. The effective date would be delayed. The one on the bottom, I won't go in order, Min Choices verbal attestation. So this was related to the similar language that we had in your bill last year. This allowed a person to give a verbal attestation rather than a signature. This was included in the EW amendment package, and it was denied by CMS. So these two things were linked in the bill, and, you know, we'll see if it's the first one is approved, but it likely will not be. The second one is use of Min Choices certifies assessors and hospitals via contracts with counties. CMS did approve this in the EW amendment, but because we had to include it in multiple amendments, we are waiting on the disability amendment approval. And then the third one, Min Choices assessor qualifications, training, and certification changes. This removed the bachelor's degree requirement. Again, this one was approved in the EW amendment, and right now we are waiting on the disability amendment approval. Okay, moving on to other HCBS changes that you had, and these are all items that were investments in the bill. The first one were CFSS rate changes as a result of the SEIU bargaining agreement. This CFSS is a state plan amendment. We are currently pending review and approval by CMS. This is one that we have received many questions from CMS on.
And we're, you know, we're currently waiting for approval and working through those. They did stop the clock here, and so we don't know what the timeline will be. But again, it is a, in a state plan amendment, so hopefully we could go back to the effective date of January 1st, 2026. The second one allows reimbursement of CFSS in acute care hospital settings. The target effective date was January 1st, 2026. This one has not yet been included in an amendment package, and so we are obviously anticipating a delay in the effective date. Right now, the department is working on our implementation plans around this and ensuring that we have controls in place as we roll that out. The third one added swimming lessons as an allowable use in CDCS and CFSS. The target effective date was January 1st, 2026. And on the disability waivers, we are, this is pending CMS review and approval. And for that set, we anticipate a delayed effective date just because it's, again, in a waiver amendment. For CFSS, no amendment is required, and so we're in the process of updating our policy pages. I would say in terms of what we've been working on with CMS on the disability items, one thing key to the bill was having a restriction on age, an age limit. I think we had 12 years and younger. And that is something that CMS has requested us to pull out of the waiver amendment. So that those are the kinds of things that we're working with them on in terms of, you know, they didn't want an age restriction if we were going to cover that in that service. Okay, the next slide goes over some of the savings items that you had for HCBS. So you guys made changes to the DWRS inflationary adjustments. Under current law, or prior to last session, the disability waiver rates inflationary adjustments were based on changes in the Bureau of Labor Statistics codes, and some items were based on CPI. Last session, the bill changed it to index it to CPI or 4%, whichever is lower, and right now that is pending CMS review and approval, and we anticipate a delayed effective date. That means that the previous adjustments will be rolling out here, and once we get approval, then the rates would adjust to what the new inflationary adjustments would be. The next one is the daily cap on individualized home supports with training. The bill last year put a six-hour cap on the service, and right now that's also pending CMS review in that same package. The bill last year also changed night supervision by modifying the rate when that service is utilizing a sleep overnight staff. That one is also pending CMS review. The next one is limiting DWRS rate exceptions. In the bill, this is effective July 1st, 2026. Right now, we are preparing for that effective date, so this one wasn't a 1-1 effective date. The next one changed made changes to how we authorize disability waiver services. The changes you made required the lead agency to have a second round of review when the person's new support plan was at a higher level than the previous year, and that DHS would need to review those changes. Right now, that is pending CMS review and approval. The next one is family residential services rate changes. This one passed into law the year prior. This changed how we, it changed the family residential services rate to be a, go from a DWRS type framework service to a tiered rate. Last year you made additional changes by changing what the tiered rates amounts are. And right now that is pending review and approval. So family residential services are still currently based on the previous rate methodology until this new rate methodology is approved. I would note life sharing was another component in a previous iteration of the bill that passed into law, and that one, that item is something we are still working through and will be putting in future amendments. So that will be a delayed item beyond even this approval. And then I put the Long-Term Services and Supports Advisory Committee item on here. This was the item where you all set up a committee that would review and recommend disability in aging long-term services and support savings items to the legislature. They have a target of about $178 million that they would have to come up with savings towards for the 28-29 biennium, and they will be submitting a report next year. I just put it on here because this was a big item in the spreadsheet, and so it doesn't require federal approval right now, but we have met the statutory deadline of starting to meet in October, and that committee is meeting at least monthly, I believe. Okay, and then quickly going into behavioral health changes. Last year's bill increased the substance use disorder rates, and that state plan amendment has been approved and it has been implemented. So that had an effective date of January 1st, 2026. The bill also disaggregated individual and group counseling. This item, the target effective date is in July. So we have the amendment drafted. It's posted. It will be posted for public comment in this month, and will likely be submitted in March or April to CMS for that target effective date. The next one is opioid treatment program rate changes. This one was a 2023 law that indexed OTP to Medicare rates. There's a typo in my slide. We did submit that for CMS approval and did get approved. There were some other changes to OTP, such as qualifications, that were in the current amendment. And so my slides got a little blurry here, but we did get approval for the original OTP rate changes. However, it's still being delayed because we are finalizing the systems work required to do that change. The mental health targeted case management rate for individuals 18 to 21 years of age. This had a target effective date of July 1st, 2025. This is another one where we have delays due to systems work. The 1115 reentry demonstration waiver. So this was the item in the 2024 session that authorized DHS to submit a waiver to CMS that would allow Medicaid payments to jails and prisons for people who are within 90 days of being released for a select set of services. Right now, we have a target approval date of June 2026 from CMS. We've been working with them with a target effective date of next January. And then last session in your bill, you authorized DHS to work with tribes on submitting a traditional healing 1115 demonstration waiver. This would allow the Medicaid system to pay for traditional healing. Currently, we are drafting the waiver. We are working directly with tribes to design the benefit with the goal of posting it for public comment shortly, likely in March, and then submit it to CMS in April or May with a target effective date of January of next year. And with that, I will pause. Those are all of the federal approval updates.
Thank you, Director Bailey. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Quick question I have for you. It's on the mental health targeted case management. You said it was delayed due to systems work. What is the projected date that that would be implemented then?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Fisher. I can get that for you. Sorry, I don't have that.
Appreciate it. Okay.
Thank Representative you. Fisher. Director Bailey, could you give us like a 10,000-foot view of how the state plan amendments work overall? I know in a call I had with Director Grom earlier this year, there was discussion that as we're going through the legislative process, these amendments are being drafted and go through that. When they get submitted to CMS, is there like one person or one team you work with consistently, or does it go into the ether and then someone gets back to you? I don't know how that process kind of just goes. Could you kind of walk us through that briefly, please? Or however long it takes for that, maybe it's not brief.
Chair Schumacher, I mean, that's a great question. In general, I would say that our staff, we have a team of federal relations staff who are experts in each of the areas. So whether, you know, the waiver team, they always work on the waivers. The state plan team always works on the state plans. And I would say the same for CMS. We, on the CMS side, we're used to working with kind of the same staff that have always process those amendments. I would say, though, that we are seeing some changes at the federal level in terms of obviously fewer staff at CMS and maybe some decision making that are that is outside of the staff that we typically work with. So there isn't really a general process. I think each state plan that we're working on or waiver amendment we're working on really varies in terms of what questions that they'll ask, you know, how long it will take. I would also say one key thing is when we are submitting a waiver plan or a state plan amendment, we could get questions on things that we're not even changing within the state plan or waiver amendment, things that may have been in there for 10, 15 years, and everything is kind of fair game, righteously so. You know, the feds are paying half the bill, and they need to ensure that whatever is in each state's plan aligns with their requirements and their guidelines. So a lot of times we're answering questions on stuff that we have already had in there, and sometimes we need to amend according to those discussions. The other thing I would note that I forgot to mention is that timing of when we submit amendments is important. So right now, for example, we have a brain injury waiver amendment in already, the amendment that we have to do every 5 years. That means that we have to wait until that's approved to submit another amendment. So if you all are making changes to the waivers and we already have something pending with CMS, we have to wait until that is approved to even submit the new amendment. So that also kind of pushes back the timeline.
Okay, thank you, Director Bailey, for that. That was helpful, insightful. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, I want to just come back to the question of H.R. 1 and some of the other federal changes coming down the pike. And first of all, I want to just say thank you for the very objective way that you addressed every one of those topics. I mean, on one side of the aisle, that H.R. 1 would create one kind of maybe inflammatory response, and on the other side, maybe another kind of response. But none of that will help you mesh with the requirements of these federal changes coming down. So your analysis in a most factual and objective way is greatly appreciated by me. And I think you've put yourself and you've put our state in the best possible place to comply with those things and not lose those dollars, right? If we spent all our time freaking out about the potential loss of dollars, we were not spending our time equipping ourselves to take the steps to not lose those dollars. So I sense that you are on track and doing so well with that, and I just wanted to say thank you. And any response?
That seems like a softball, Representative Gander. Director Bailey.
Well, Chair Schumacher, I will take a softball any day. Thank you. I would say we have a whole team at DHS really digging into this, and I would also say the counties are coming up to the table with us. And we've really established a collaborative effort with them on how do we as a system mitigate harm to people. And because a lot of the changes will make the system that much more complex, whether or not you agree with, say, doing work requirements, at the end of the day, some people may fall off just simply because they didn't turn in a document, right? So we want to make sure that we mitigate harm and that we actually set up a system that is smoother and more simple than we have now. I would say a lot of the issues also that we're working with are the system isn't simple to begin with. You know, we're starting at a place where the baseline doesn't necessarily meet the needs of people, or the counties have, you know, workloads that aren't sufficient, honestly, to really work with people. And so we're working through those and trying our best to make sure that if we have to make these changes, let's make them in a way that actually improves the system.
Thank you. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. do want to bring back that HR1. How many individuals will be losing their coverage based on the estimate given under HR1?
Director Bailey.
Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, I don't have that off the tip of my fingers, but I can get that. I can get you some numbers that we are estimating in the November forecast, I believe.
Chair Noor.
About 140,000 individuals who are within the expansion group may likely lose their coverage because of the new requirement. Also, how much are we seeing from the counties? Because right now you've got a system that is aging and we're requiring the counties to do, twice reviewing the same information that it used to be annually. Have you been hearing from the counties that it's increasing their task in terms of doing approvals?
Director Bailey.
Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, we are working with the counties in terms of what the work plan will be. Right now, we are assessing whether we can use external sources to assist with external vendors to assist with the increased volume of work. There is also some interlap with the same population right now. We already have periodic data matching. And so there is a portion in the system that the state is already doing to check eligibility at the six-month mark. So we are working with the counties, though, to, as I said earlier, kind of establish a more streamlined approach and try to mitigate increased workload on the counties as much as possible.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Bailey, the $515 million quarterly withholding or deferral that you mentioned, how are we going to choose which programs we're going to cut in Medicaid, because that is what the federal government is now, you know, putting the threat that they're going to withhold, $515 million. How do we choose which programs we're going to be eliminating based on that number being cut from the state, about $2 billion a year?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Noor, my understanding is that it will impact the state's bottom line and that it will be up to the legislature to determine how to balance the state budget. So it won't be a direct change to the Medicaid program. It will have to be decisions made by lawmakers on how to balance the state budget. So whether it be Medicaid or roads and bridges, it will be a question that everyone will have to grapple with.
Chair Noor.
It's a good starting point. So we need to have that exercise ready to go.
With that, Director Bailey, if you'd like to continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. I'm going to hand it off to my colleague, Ms. Grum.
Welcome to committee, Director Grum. Have you introduced yourself already?
Mr. Chair, I have, but I can say it again. Christy Grum with the Department of Human Services for the record.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, so I was asked today to start providing some updates on program integrity implementation items that were passed in the 2025 legislative session, and I believe we'll have a continuation of this discussion tomorrow. So we're going to just start with some one of the big reforms that the legislature enacted last session related to early intensive developmental behavioral intervention, also known as EIDBI, which is an autism service. So last session, you might remember, we talked with the committee and did a pretty robust presentation on EIDBI and some of the work that the department has been doing over the years. So I wanted to just delve into a little bit of a refresh on that topic before we get into what passed and some of those implementation updates. So just as a reminder for folks that are a little bit newer or need a refresher, EIDBI is a medical assistance benefit. This was authorized by the 2014 legislature, and it provides medically necessary intervention services for children and for young adults, so people under 21 years of age, with autism spectrum disorder or related conditions. In addition to those intensive direct intervention services, this is a service that also provides education and training and support to families. It can be provided in schools and community settings as well as in a center-based setting. And it's really an important service to make sure that kids are able to stay in their homes and in their communities and be supported in participating in the full extent of community life. So before EIDBI was implemented, there wasn't really a service like this. There were similar services that were being provided, but there was really a gap in the system, which is why this service was created and established by the legislature. A few other just maybe quick notes on this. There are a few different treatment modalities authorized under EIDBI. Those are outlined in statute. And this is part of our state plan services that Ms. Bailey mentioned. It's part of our EPSDT benefit, the early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment benefit, just to give you some of that context on the jargon. And that is a required benefit in under Medicaid, EPSDT. So if, you know, there were changes to this, we would have to make sure that we're providing those autism services in some way to children and families that need them. So maybe skipping over some of the detail here, but happy to answer questions. Over the years, DHS, in partnership with the legislature, has identified gaps in this service. It's a newer benefit. And we've worked with you all to make some changes. So, for example, when this benefit was first initiated, first implemented, there weren't any background study requirements. So for many years, DHS came to the legislature asking to implement background study requirements. And I think we got those maybe in about 2021, finally. There was a variety of other changes and reforms that we worked with you all on to make sure we're part of this benefit. One of the glaring gaps that the department has noticed for many years is that this service was not licensed. And this is a clinical service that really is in need of licensure. So in 2023, DHS came to the legislature and said, we would really like to do a study and evaluation and hopefully get some funding to engage with community. We knew this would be a controversial topic and really understand what the national, you know, landscape is here. What are other states doing when it comes to regulations on services like EIDBI services? And what does the community think? What can we do to promote health and safety and strong program integrity controls? So the 2023 legislature authorized that study. And at the department, we broke that up into three parts. So it was a really robust study with three different phases. And all of this culminated in a final report last year, January of 2025. And we presented on those recommendations in that report in this committee last session. So I won't rehash that, but I did just want to remind the committee that all of the work that the legislature enacted around EIDBI licensure last session really came out of those that work from the department and those recommendations. So just to summarize some of the recommendations, it was very clear in our studies and an evaluation with the community that licensure was necessary. I don't think there was any disagreement from anyone that we needed to license this service. There were recommendations related to making sure that services and regulations that we do impose were really tailored to the setting type, so making sure that we weren't creating, you know, onerous requirements for kids and families that need to access these services in communities or in school settings versus maybe a center setting. There were also recommendations related to investigating maltreatment and making sure that the department was able to investigate and act on maltreatment that we were hearing about immediately. There were some really severe occurrences that that were reported in the media related to this issue, and we needed to make sure that we made that change. And then report or recommendations were also centered around not just regulations, but also clinical requirements and oversight, making sure that clinicians were trained, that there was the appropriate supervision in place, that maybe lower level staff that provide and deliver EIDBI services had the supports that they needed to be successful so that we had good outcomes in this service. So a little bit different than licensure regulations, but we can talk about some of those changes that happened last session. So in 2025, the legislature did establish a provisional licensure. This was a governor's recommendation based on all of the reports that I mentioned just a bit ago. And some of the key components of this licensure requires or allows DHS to have the authority to enter an agency without advance notice, to investigate maltreatment reports and complaints against agencies, We are able now to issue corrective actions and sanctions once this provisional licensure starts. And just a few notes on timing. So this will begin on January 1, 2026, that people, agencies will have to, DHS can begin issuing provisional licenses, and then EIDBI agencies have until the end of this May to submit an application. Between the end of May and the beginning of next year, DHS will review all of those applications, make sure that the applicant, you know, or determine if the applicant is complying with all of the parameters of the provisional licensure, and either make a decision to deny or approve the provisional licensure by the end of December in 2026. So after that, agencies, EIDBI agencies, if they do not have a provisional licensure, will no longer be able to operate and bill for Medicaid in Minnesota. Also in this legislation was a requirement that DHS is parallel to all of the work around establishing the comprehensive license or the provisional license. We are to be working on a comprehensive, more permanent licensure structure. And that also requires a lot of engagement with our community partners. So the legislature asked DHS to work with the EIDBI Advisory Council to begin to develop those recommendations, which we'll be bringing back to the legislature in 2027. So a few notes in terms of implementation and updates for the committee. So we did launch the application in last month in January of 2026. As of mid this month, I think maybe last week or so, we received 5 complete applications. One thing to note about the language that passed last session is the legislature did include a provider enrollment moratorium for EIDBI. There were some hoops that we had to jump through to make that happen with CMS, some discussions we had to have with the administration, but we were able to submit that in August, and we got approval for that with an effective date of November 1, 2025. So effectively, that means from an implementation perspective, I believe that moratorium lasts about 6 months, and we may be able to ask for another approval from CMS. So right now, we aren't accepting new EIDBI providers. But we do need to make sure that all the current providers that are enrolled are going through this provisional licensure process. So that's why that's important to know. Right now, we're in the final stages of developing dashboards. I believe these will be for both internal and external use. So as soon as we have those public, happy to share those with the committee for the community and just for DHS to be able to track how many applications we're receiving, how many licenses we're issuing, and agencies that haven't yet applied. So whenever we have a big systems reform like this, we want to be tracking, are folks keeping up? Are we providing enough guidance? Are agencies able to follow this process and get enrolled and submit the application and comply? Or do we need to do more as a department to communicate and support provider agencies in transitioning to the licensure? Our hiring, our EIDBI licensing unit is currently hiring. We've got, I think, 8 positions to fill. So I know that work is underway. I don't have details on the exact hiring numbers, but I know it's positions have been posted and they've been working on that. And as I mentioned, just wanted to highlight this again, that our team, our licensing team, our policy team are both working together on this, and it is a huge lift to implement a new license for a service. We're doing, you know, a provisional licensure that the legislature passed, but parallel to that, it is a huge lift to figure out all of the provider standards and other regulatory requirements. So just a shout out to our teams for working really hard on this truncated timeline. We understand there's a need to get this stood up as soon as possible, for sure. So I wanted to just cover quickly a little bit about provisional licensure, external engagement. So we, right off the bat, when this provision was passed, we worked with our communications team and with others to develop a community engagement and communications plan. We know there's a lot of questions and concerns anytime there's a big systems change like this, so it was really important to us that we've got that we had a robust communications plan, and that the engagement wasn't just one-sided, that it was not just DHS saying, this is what we think, but actually saying what we're thinking, getting the feedback, and then coming back to the you know, EIDBI Advisory Council and other interested parties to say, here's how we integrated your feedback, or we don't agree with that and we can't move forward that way, whatever the situation may be. So we've done A couple of sessions with the EADBI Advisory Council. I note on the slide we did one in August, early August. We've also met with them in November and had some general discussions around the licensure. And in that November meeting, the council broke up and created some subgroups to work on specific aspects of the licensure. So all of that work is informing the DHS process as well. And we'll continue to engage with that council. We've sent multiple communication notices to agencies, just letting them know, hey, remember, you can apply now. You know, there's a deadline. Try to get your application in as soon as possible. We've established a website, which you can go to. I think there's a link in this slide, but there's a listserv sign-up so that people can get updates on what's going on with the licensure. There's an email address for questions. We don't think of everything that people are going to wonder about, and so we need to understand what questions are in the community and update our documents and communications appropriately. And then we've got an FAQ as well for providers and community members. So that, in a really quick nutshell, is where we're at with the EADBI licensure. But I did want to mention some other changes that were made last session that I referenced earlier, primarily related to clinical oversight and some other oversight aspects of EADBI. So one of the things that the commissioner did, Commissioner Gandhi did last spring, was administratively she announced that, and we had to notify providers of this, that EADBI would become a high-risk service. That is a designation that CMS defines. It's not a judgment on the service at all, but it's just sort of these federal definitions. There's high risk, moderate risk, and I think low risk, perhaps. And so that change required that we do increased revalidation. So basically we go in and we check on providers to make sure from an enrollment perspective, from a program integrity perspective, are you meeting the requirements of the service? For moderate risk, I believe that happens every 5 years, which I think is what EADBI was before. With high risk, they are now at a cadence of every 3 year revalidation. So that change was codified in statute as well last session. We also had some changes to EADBI background studies, which in part relates to the designation change that I just mentioned, strengthening those background study requirements and really making sure that professionals that are delivering services to children who need these services are meeting all of the expectations and able to deliver those services safely. Last session, the legislature also modified the list of approved treatment modalities. I mentioned that in statute, there's a list of treatment modalities, and some of the recommendations in the reports when we worked with community, when we talked with the legislature last session, was to maybe slim down that list. There was a few of those services that have never been provided, and there was also authority for DHS to add to that list at our discretion. And it was the consensus of DHS and the legislature that we should, I believe, remove that discretion and then also remove one of the modalities. So focusing on, you know, what the services and the interventions that are most used so that we can monitor most effectively. And then also importantly, this was a big part of the discussions last session. There was a change around clinical supervision. So we went back and forth as a committee, as a conference committee, on what this requirement would be. But this change required clinical supervision at a minimum of 1 hour for every 16 hours of direct treatment per person, unless the person's individual treatment plan or ITP specified otherwise. Generally speaking, those requirements are in line with the ABA practice guide and with other clinical recommendations. So that was a really important aspect of something that changed last year with regard to supervision. I would say, just to maybe note for the committee, I think this was a huge piece of language and change, and we do want to come back this session. We may have some policy provisions to share with this committee, if you're open to those, about how we can strengthen the language even further. There are some documentation requirements that we would like to add, as well as some clarification around observation, basically the supervision service, to make sure that that's only being conducted by a qualified supervising professional, to make sure that we have the highest level of credentials overseeing that supervision. So that's just a little bit of a precursor to maybe future discussions on this service that we'd love to work with this committee on. And I think that's all I have for you today, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer questions and looking forward to having more discussion tomorrow.
Thank you, Director Grom. And we have members about 20 minutes on the list so far. I have Representative Hicks, Franzen, Curran, and Gilman. Representative Hicks.
I don't have any questions, but I do want to just take a moment to sort of ground us as we go into this conversation. So I don't know if I'm the only autism mommy on this committee or not, but I am an autism mommy. And when EIDBI was coming through the legislature in 2015 and 2016, I was not here. I was in the depths of trying to teach my kiddo how to talk. I was in the depths of trying to get us potty trained to be able to go to preschool and kindergarten. I was in the depths of IEP meetings and conversations about intervention, and I was working through ABA techniques in our home to get him to be the amazing young man that many of you have met today. But I was in the depths of that, and it was rough, y'all. We were doing all the things. And this was going through the legislature, and I was watching it as a mom. And I remember thinking, they're not going to license that? Wait, what? It's not going to be certified? And I remember being appalled. And then I remember noticing that they didn't even require background checks to work with my nonverbal child. And when I say they, I mean this body. And to be fair, I was not here. So that one's not on me. But some of y'all were. It was a... And we were in divided government. And the chair in the Senate at the time was Senator Abler. And Senator Abler and I worked really hard last session to make some of these changes from our unique lenses. But I want to ground all of us in how many kids we're talking about. Minnesota has a very high autism rate. It's not the highest in the country, but it's high. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of those reasons being that our systems work together to identify kids early. So in Minnesota, we have preschool screening and early intervention, both in Medicaid and in schools. And our pediatricians are required to take training on how to screen for autism. And so we catch kids earlier in Minnesota than a lot of other states. And we should be super, super proud of that. In Minnesota, 1 in 28 8-year-olds has autism. Children with autism make up 3.6% of the population. It is the fastest growing special education category in our K-12 system. When we started tracking this data, now 20 years ago, those 8-year-olds are now 28, and the percentage has just continued to rise. And 20 years ago, when we started tracking this data, over 70% of individuals with autism had a coexisting condition of intellectual disability, meaning their IQs were below 70. Now, because of the work of EIDBI providers, school professionals, preschool teachers, Head Start teachers, all of the amazing early intervention folks we have in our state, along with strong parent advocates and advocacy organizations, we have flipped that number around. Based on the most recent data from the University of Minnesota, about 37% of people with autism of 8-year-olds with autism have a coexisting intellectual disability. I need you all to think about what that means. That means that 43%, almost half, or more than half, sorry, 53, whatever, I can't do math, more, kids with autism don't have an intellectual disability. They have autism, but their IQs are above 70. That means that their abilities to function in our world with supports go up. And many of them still have a variety of different support needs. But we have seen early intervention work in this state over the last 20 years. We've seen it work. And we can keep seeing it work if we work together to make the changes that we need to make, both based on some of the things that we maybe didn't get done last year that need to be pushed a little bit harder, but also in 27 when we move to a full license, that will be work that will help children for generations. And so as we go into the nitty-gritty discussions of this program today and tomorrow and whatever that looks like, I need you all to ground in that you are talking about 3.6% of children. Almost 4% of our children. And then we're also talking, when we talk about 3.6% of children, and that's based on the U's data, right? That's the University of Minnesota's data. When we're talking about that percentage of children, 1 in 28, that means one in every classroom. We're also talking about their siblings, their parents, and their grandmas, their aunties, and all the Minnesotans who are impacted by early intervention.
Thank you for that perspective, Representative Hicks. Representative Franzen.
Thank you. I am wondering if you know, if you could drill down on the related services. You've mentioned related services a couple of times. So if you could just give us some examples of what those related services would be.
Director Grom.
Pretty broad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, the one that comes to mind, the related service that comes to mind for me is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. But I would have to double check the list. Those are specified in, and Representative Hicks is saying she might know more specifics. Those are specified in our provider manual, but happy to come back and get you more information on that.
Representative Franzen.
Well, I think that if you're going to talk about mention related services, you should be expecting that the lawmakers are going to ask you what related services, and that's something you should have been prepared for today.
Thank you, Representative Franz. And Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, too, for presenting the information. And I just want to also just I want to emphasize that committee members understand the role that you're specifically the two of you are placed in being messengers for what's happening at DHS versus what's happening at the legislature and where we might differ. And I appreciate that the two of you have to come to us as messengers, and hopefully you don't feel too personally attacked by some things that have been points of contention between the legislature and DHS. Itself. So certainly just want to say that respect both of your positions and what you do and why you're here. My question is sort of like more of a general question that just came up in the provisional licensing of EIDBI. There's a point where it says that DHS has authority to enter the physical premises of an agency without advance notice, which to me makes total sense that any place, if it's certified, licensed, whoever that certification or licensing authority, should be able to walk in any time to make sure that you're doing business correctly. That makes complete sense to me. As long as the people who are receiving services, whether they're children or adults who may be vulnerable, as long as they're protected and safe, right? And we don't want them to be scared or have their day interrupted, minimal disruption. And I think that's typically how it goes. But that led me to the question of, you know, that applies to programs that DHS oversees or licenses that DHS could enter without advance notice. Can any other local, state, or federal agencies gain entry for the purposes of investigating without notice? Mm-hmm.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Curran, thank you for your initial comments. I always appreciate the checks and balances and your critical feedback at times. I'm not sure if federal agencies are able to access, for example, like, the Department of Justice or maybe other agencies that might be investigating fraud or something like that. I believe they need a warrant, but I'm not certain on those requirements. We would have to take that back to probably others in our law enforcement agencies to double check.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you. I think what I'm more specifically getting at is, are there Are there other entities or other government agencies outside of the Minnesota Department of Human Services who would have authority to show up at a DHS license program without notice? Without notice or without warrant. DHS doesn't need a warrant, right, because it's licensed. They're the ones that are the licensing authority. So without notice and without a warrant, could local police show up at a program that DHS oversees to just do their own unprompted investigation without notice?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kern, I really am not certain. I don't want to give you an answer that's incorrect. You might have an inkling, and happy to hear that from other committee members that might know, but I'm not really prepared to talk about what other law enforcement agencies or other state agencies are able to do at these settings.
Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that. I think this dialogue here has shown us that there is not enough clarity, maybe, in some of the ways that we're different agencies and community members try to approach making sure that programs are running efficiently and safely. And so, as we discuss who, in fact, does have authority to make those decisions and who the experts are to ensure that programs are running successfully, I think that should be part of our discussion to ensure that we're not placing that responsibility on agencies who are not the experts on these services. Thank you.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate those comments, and I will say that we have heard from other types of license settings, for example, community residential services, where local law enforcement has shown up just sort of demanding information from those settings. And we've heard from those providers that there was a lot of fear with those interactions. And so we have been trying to work with law enforcement when those situations arise to make sure that we're coordinating and that they understand what the expectations are of the service and whose role it is to identify potential licensing issues. Of course, if there's a public safety issue, that's more their lane. But when it comes to licensing or service standards, that's in the DHS lane.
Thank you, Representative Kern. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Director Grom. And thank you to my colleagues. We've had lots of conversations outside of us being in session, and it's really good to get a grip on history, but then also what are we here to do? So my question, I've got a couple questions. High risk, when things, do you have a, you said that this program was deemed high risk. When other programs in DHS are deemed high risk, moderate, is there a process that you have in place when that happens? If we're in session, out of session, how do things work with that? And I would love just to have, if you don't have that information on you, we need it. We need to know if you don't have a system in place when things are high risk. That's where our constituents, our people, our loved ones that we know, if you're, saying one in 28 kids are impacted by this. I want to know when things are high risk, do all the alarms sound at DHS and it's all hands on deck to ensure that you get out of that high-risk category. So is there a policy in place for that when that happens? That's one question I have.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there is a policy and a process that DHS uses. We ourselves as the Medicaid agency are the entity that identifies when a service, when we see there are some issues with this service, we're seeing maybe more reports to OIG, allegations, credible allegations of fraud. In those instances, that's when the commissioner is using that information that the OIG is feeding to our leadership to understand where do we need to make adjustments to the risk levels. So that's definitely starts at the department. There is a process in terms of what we need to do once the commissioner has reviewed the information from the Office of Inspector General and understands and is making a decision that something, its service needs to move to high risk. There's a process by which we have to notify providers before that designation occurs. So that's a process that we have in place at the agency and that we can do administratively. And then the two, I think, most critical changes when it relates to moving from moderate risk to high risk or no risk to high risk are the revalidation changes. Mm-hmm. And we do probably want to do, we clarified for EADBI what those are in statute, but we do have authority to do revalidation, different kinds of revalidations. I will say CMS is requiring us now to, as part of our corrective action plan, to do another level of revalidations, and some of what CMS is requiring we've noted is not completely congruent with state law, so we will probably be coming to the legislature to talk with all of you about making sure that state law does allow us to go in and do those revalidations as needed. And then the other change, so we've generally have authority to do that, but I think we could use some clarification. The other change is related to background studies. So for high-risk provider types, the background study is a little bit more enhanced, and I believe it's the part of it that's different is that it requires fingerprinting. And so those are some changes that that we probably need authority and sometimes funding to enact. And we did some of that last session, but we'll continue to work with you when those needs are present. And on to your last point, I think it's important to know, yes, providers can move out of the high-risk category, and hopefully that's the goal, right? If we don't have to do that level of oversight, if we aren't seeing that there's gaps in compliance or, you know, increases in fraudulent, potentially fraudulent activity, we don't need to do this level of oversight. So the goal is to get all of those controls in place through state law, through, you know, administrative procedures, and to make sure that we can support providers in being compliant and potentially move to a lower level of risk.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you. And just to follow up, you talked about policy provisions and having some things ready to roll for us to look at and to review, to put into practice. Why didn't you have some of those things ready for us right now? As we come into this session, like, it would be so helpful while we're here to have, you know, in the interim when you're working, we're all working and doing things as well. I'm just curious why some of those things weren't brought to us like right now so we could get working on that. It's just something I have.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, they are ready right now. And I'm happy to come back tomorrow and do a hearing on our policy provisions as they relate to EIDBI. The bills are with the revisor getting jacketed, but we have the language. We've been perfecting that over. We start our process in the middle of session. So last session already, these provisions were being drafted. Once Lisa and I get done with negotiations, we sometimes get a little bit of a breather, but usually we're back right at it, looking at what do we need to bring back. So those have been ready over the summer, and we're happy to share those with you.
Wonderful. Good. Last thing I want to follow up
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, is do you have a list of services or programs that are tied to Medicaid dollars that are not licensed?
Director Grom.
I just want to know, is there a list? Is there a way that we can, because I'm just going to, again.
Representative Gilman.
We are talking about, for example, traditional healing, 1115. That is not a licensed service. And so as we're going into making new laws, new changes to tying things to Medicaid dollars, if there's an opportunity for waste, fraud, and abuse to be happening, or folks to skirt around not having good guardrails, we need to ensure that when we're putting new things into law, are how many services right now are licensed or aren't licensed? I would love to have more information on that, too.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, I am not certain if there's a formal list on our website. I know I've seen lists. Certainly nonpartisan staff can probably support you in identifying what those services are. But in the spirit of transparency, that's something we would be happy to post on our website if that would be helpful. We can share that information with you, but it is available. And you're right. We should be, if we're adding new benefits, particularly benefits that are clinical in nature, that are, you know, maybe in some cases not overseen by clinicians that also hold a professional license with a board, with the health board here in Minnesota, we really do need to scrutinize what we're doing and making sure that we have the appropriate infrastructure in terms of licensing and regulations, also in terms of staffing in the Office of Inspector General and other areas of the department to ensure compliance. So I think your point is very well taken. Lastly, I would just say, I don't think that we need to license every single service. I don't think that that would be the ideal situation, but I do agree with examining everything that we're adding in current services to make sure we've got the right supports in place.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. And with that, Directors Grom, Directors Bailey, thank you for your time this morning. And we stand adjourned until Thursday, February 19th. We get to be here at 8:15. See you then.